good afternoon. Welcome. This is Mike Harris from the Jeff Rentz Radio Network, and today is Monday, April 29th, 2013. And I hope everybody had a good weekend. I certainly did. You know, spent some time outdoors because the weather is finally permitting it. It's just a blessing to be able to go outside and not have it be 110 degrees. Anyway, my guest today is Harold Covington, author and social commentator. Harold, how are you?
Pretty good, Mike. Able to sit up and take a little nourishment from time to time.
Well, that's good. You need to take nourishment now and then. Need a little sustenance. Anyway, I just wanted to invite you on the radio show today because you address many of the social ills that our country has been inflicted with since really the Kennedy assassination is really when things started to go downhill, at least in my opinion. That's when I noticed was after Kennedy was assassinated. So, you know, here we are today. It's 2013. We just had this Boston bombing. We've got this gun control debate. We've got the immigration reform nonsense going on. Where do you come down on these things? What do you think we should be doing? Because what I see is the mainstream media only tells about 10% of the story. They leave out 90%. They use that to misdirect us, and they only give us the information they want us to have. So nobody out there can make a truly informed decision.
Mm-hmm. Well, you want to know where I think we should be going, you need to read my 5 Northwest Independence novels. This slow deterioration that we've been undergoing for the past 50 years is starting to speed up, definitely. After Obama's re-immaculation, the Democrats either went crazy just out of plain hubris or else they're desperate to get their agenda through before things really fall to pieces. I was surprised myself at how fast they cracked in on their what is obviously going to be the 2 main points in their strategy for the next 4 years, which is the gun control, the seizing of privately held firearms so that white people can no longer resist whatever the government decides to inflict on them, and also so-called immigration reform, which is otherwise known as the Register 33 Million New Democrats.
Well, I want to debate you on that one because I don't think it's 33 million. I think it's 50 million minimum, maybe closer to 60 million. Because
Nobody knows. For
20 plus years, they've been using this 11 million illegal alien figure in this country.
Oh, yeah, that's way off, yeah.
And they're bringing in between 7,500 and 10,000 of them every night down the border where I'm at in Arizona. That's way too many.
I did an article for another website a few days ago wherein some think tank figured out that through the various loopholes, they put the figure that will be legalized under the Gang of Eight bill at 33 million. But they also pointed out that it creates a chain reaction. Once you legalize, oh, let's say 33 million or whatever, then they fulfill the function which used to be fulfilled by the anchor babies. The newly legalized and amnestied Mexicans and third worlders in this country can then start bringing in their mothers and fathers and uncles and brothers and cousins 3 times removed and, you know,
isn't that called chain migration?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Yeah, and that was why in the past few decades, there a lot of the illegal immigrants that were hustled across the border in Arizona and California and Texas and places like that by these coyotes consisted of a large number of pregnant women. The idea being to have their baby born in the charity ward of some hospital in Brownsville or Phoenix or San Diego, wherever, but that baby, under current law, being born in the United States, would be a United States citizen.
Actually, Harold, I have to take exception to that because the 14th Amendment needs to have a constitutional challenge. It is assumed that that is a valid, that the anchor baby designation is valid. I don't think it is. I've read the 14th Amendment. I don't see anything in there. And I think that there needs to be some lawsuit put up that takes this thing to the Supreme Court so we can get this clarified. Does the 14th Amendment really grant this to these anchor babies, or is that a bunch of BS? And I think the liberals have been hiding behind this one for a long time, and I think we need to challenge it. I think it really needs to be grab that bull by the horns and wrestle him.
Well, good luck getting any kind of pro-white change through the existing system, Mike. I've become just a total complete cynic in my old age. I believe that the present American legal, judicial, and legislative process has become completely corrupt, and that any attempt to work within any of it, either the electoral system or the judiciary or the Supreme Court or lawsuits or anything like that, is simply useless. I won't go too wild and woolly on your show here, but anyone who's read my novels knows what I think about these things. Let me put it this way. It is time for us to take action in order to bring about change in this country. That is the first peremptory principle that we have to operate under and live under. The world must change. That is now no longer an option. We have to stop talking about it. We have to start doing it. Now, in order to bring about change, it cannot be done within the system. The current system is utterly beyond redemption. And once you accept the fact in your own mind that the current system is utterly beyond redemption, you have to start looking at alternatives and options, which my books do. There are others who are beginning finally to look at such options, which I find an encouraging sign. Put it this way, there are a lot more people talking the talk than there were this time, say, 5 years ago. The question is, will they walk the walk? Get all these sheriffs and whatnot in Wyoming and Montana and places in the West vowing and swearing that they're not going to force gun control laws. You get state legislatures trying to bring back a gold standard. You get even some governors who are making feisty comments. Okay, that's fine. Like I say, that's talking the talk is progress of a sort, but we have to see when the rubber meets the road whether or not they'll walk the walk and whether they will actually resist the tyranny coming from Washington, D.C., and whether or not they will bring about actual change. If people don't want to do my separatist thing and establish a homeland for white people in the Northwest Republic, I suppose that after some form of white separatism, the best option would be a return to states' rights and the dissolution and hamstringing of the federal central government. But
well, Harold, I've read your books. I've read all of them, and I like them. I think they're fun. They're action-adventure novels with a touch of science fiction because you go 50, 100 years in the future in some of them. And they're a great, exciting read. But still, most people haven't given up on the concept of a constitutional republic that the U.S. is. And so they maybe the time has passed, and maybe they're hanging on to it for too long. I don't know. But people just don't want to let go of that concept because you know
what they're used to. Yeah. Well, what they don't understand is that while they've been twiddling their thumbs and messing around with lawsuits and Supreme Court appeals and the internet and tea parties and all that sort of stuff, the white man has become outnumbered in this country, effectively speaking. We're still not, as far as sheer numbers, outnumbered quite yet, but we have become outnumbered at the polls, which is the significant area where it really counts. Our electoral system is such that it gives undue weight to these 8 or 10 huge, populous, minority-heavy states, New York, California, Pennsylvania, Texas, Florida, Illinois, basically where the big cities are and where the black and brown minorities are. These states swing a huge number of votes in the electoral college as opposed to the more sparsely populated and much, much whiter states like Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, Iowa, even some of the New England states, New Hampshire, Vermont, et cetera, et cetera. In essence, the weight of the electoral system is now behind the non-whites. Effectively speaking, white people are now outvoted at the polls, and anything electoral or political that's going to be done within the system will have to take that into account. This is why the Republicans are already trying to backpedal and make themselves more easy on, quote, immigration and all this sort of stuff. I hear the music.
Well, there's the music. That's our signal for our break. And stick around, folks. Listen to our sponsors. We'll be right back. More with Harold Covington. Thank you. Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on the Rents Radio Network, and my guest today is Harold Covington, and it's Monday, April 29th, 2013. So, Harold, welcome back. So, anyway, I've read your books. I am as frustrated as anybody with what's going on in this country. I think one of the problems we have is that a lot of people don't even bother to vote anymore. The voter turnout has been going down and down and down, and especially since the Bush coronation when he was appointed dictator by the Supreme Court and was not duly elected. But, you know, people don't even bother to vote, but the minorities have figured out that if they vote for the right Democrats, they can get better and better benefits. They get more and more stuff.
Yeah, it's like that 18th century Scottish economist, I believe his name was Robeson, wrote, "Democracy always fails when men discover that they can vote themselves money from the public funds." And what democracy has produced is a whole culture of what you might call wheeler-dealer patronage rule. It goes back in this country to people like Boss Tweed and Mayor Daley in Chicago. And,
the whole Tammany Hall thing in New York.
Oh, yeah, Tammany Hall. A lot of the old Democrat-run political machines we had in the South were the same way. Basically, a corrupt clique gets a hold of the public treasury, and they use it to buy votes and keep themselves in power, and this now is being done on a national scale by the Democrats. I sound like I'm pro-Republican, by the way, but the Democrats basically have won the tussle for the public purse, so to speak, and so they're the main villains at the moment, and so they're the ones I tend to talk about more. But please don't get the idea that I've forgotten the ears of George W. Bush. I haven't. But in essence, what the Democrats are doing, and Limbaugh and some of the neocons do have this right, they have artificially created an entire majority for themselves at the polls through a combination of minority votes of an already existing nature, i.e. immigrants and blacks, and a new shot of illegal immigrants who are now being amnestied and registered. For example, just before the election, Obama put in the DREAM Act. This was after Congress had rejected it twice. And just before the election, thousands and thousands and thousands of Mexicans were registering all over the country, especially in places like Chicago. I personally am convinced that illegal aliens have, in fact, been voting in this country for many, many years.
Oh, I'm absolutely convinced of that. Absolutely convinced, because they shouldn't have the influence at the polls that they have if they're truly illegal, if they're not voting. So they're compounding their lawbreaking by voting in our elections, and it's just despicable that every Secretary of State has not, you know, scoured those voting registries and get them out of here.
Well, when certain Republican-run states try to get rid of them, they go running to the Justice Department and running to the courts to demand that they stop removing dead people and illegal aliens. See, the Democrats are also creating, I hate to say this, a white underclass as well. They're taking advantage of the economic problems of 2009 and 2010, so forth, the foreclosures. And right now there are, 50, 60 million people on food stamps? And all of these benefits, the food stamps, the EBT cards, the Obama phones, I hate to say it, but a lot of whites are taking advantage of this now. And so from now on, when there's an election, the Democrats will go running to these people who are getting all these government goodies and say, oh, no, you must continue to vote for us. These horrible Republicans are going to take away your food stamps and take away your EBT cards and take away your Social Security disability and take away this, that, and the other, all these government things that you're getting. And of course, in a sense, they're right. The Republicans do want to take away a lot of these benefits, send us back to the good old days of laissez-faire capitalism where 10-year-olds worked for 14 hours a day in mines. And so we shouldn't have a choice between two evils in this country, but that's all we've had for almost 100 years, and that's part of the problem, is there's never been a real choice. That's one of the reasons that you say that nobody's voting anymore. It's because there is no choice. You've got
alternatives. Harold, it's the old thing, would you rather have arsenic or cyanide? They're both going to kill you. Which one do you want? We've got two lousy choices that are absolutely toxic to this country. And, you know, I'll never forget the 8 years of hell that George W. Bush's presidency was. I mean, he was probably one of the two worst presidents of my lifetime, the other one being Lyndon B. Johnson.
I think Obama is worse because Bush was just basically a jugular little alcoholic who allowed himself to be run by people like Cheney and the neocons and the Israeli lobby. But Obama and the Democrats who are behind him, the Jews like Rahm Emanuel and Cass Sunstein and David Axelrod, are changing the very nature of American society. Again, this is something that Limbaugh and some of the more perceptive neocons do have right. We are, in essence, being transformed into a Marxism-lite social democratic welfare state. One of the things that scares me most of all is this plan for the FHA or various government agencies to buy up all these foreclosed houses and then, in essence, rent them back either to former owners or to new voters. They could also, of course, use that to force housing integration onto various white neighborhoods and so forth and so on. But I've lived in socialist countries in England and Ireland, and one of the main mechanisms of control that the government has over the majority of the population of those countries is through what's called council housing. In socialist countries, the government is actually the main landlord. I don't know if you've ever been over there and you've seen these big, huge housing estates or these big, huge apartment blocks, but in many cases, if you, like, are in a labor-controlled council in England and you have a National Front or a British National Party poster in your window, you can actually be evicted from your home for racism. So the control of housing is one form of political control, a very potent one, especially if you've got a family.
Well, Harold, we've got a break coming up here. I hear our music in the background, so stick with us, folks. More from Harold Covington. afternoon and welcome back. This is Mike Harris on RinceRadio.com. Today my guest is author Harold Covington, and today is Monday, April 29th, 2013. And Harold, talking about this housing thing, I think that is part of a bigger plan. I think that the whole play with housing, the mortgage fraud, all of that was really part of a plan to strip assets from the American people and put them under government and or corporate control. You have to look at over 12 million American families were dispossessed during that, over 12 million. I don't have an accurate number, but that's, I know that number is safe to use. And these banks are still holding many of these foreclosed properties on their books as performing assets. They're not being GAAP compliant, which means generally accepted accounting practices. Therefore, they're committing fraud against their shareholders and investors by not reporting these asset values accurately, trying to prop up and maintain their loan portfolios. And then these houses that are foreclosed, many people who've wanted to buy a particular property cannot because the bank refuses to sell it. They insist on bundling them in groups of 100 or 500 or 1,000 homes you have to buy all at the same time.
Still off the paper, yeah.
And they're selling off the papers, selling off to big institutional investors. And now with this being an FHA repurchase, then that gives it back into government control, like you said, for rental and another facet of control over the American people. And I think this is all part of an orchestrated plan in order, like I said, to dispossess the American people and make them totally dependent upon both corporate largesse and on government handouts.
Absolutely. They're going after the 401ks now as well. They've come up with some new plan that they're going to limit how much you can contribute to your 401k. They're going to top it off at like $2.7 million for 401ks and IRAs because, quote unquote, you don't need any more than that to retire. And secondly, as I understand it, the plan that's floating around in our Lord's and Master's mind is to create some big, huge sort of allegedly privatized version of Social Security where everybody puts their 401ks and their IRAs in one big, huge pool, which in essence the government can access because they're legally prohibited from accessing the Social Security kitty, although they do.
Well, they've been borrowing against Social Security for years now.
Yeah. So in essence, they're trying to create another big, huge slush fund with other people's money that the government, with a little bit of razzle-dazzle, can use to give things to minorities and to Democrat constituencies. That's another one of these redistribution of wealth things under a very fancy title. But the kicker is that, number one, you will be getting only 70 cents on the dollar or whatever. You give them $100,000 401k into this pool, you'll actually be credited with $70,000, something like that. And also, you pay into your 401k, your IRA, you pay out of your gross, and that amount that you pay is not taxed. So that will be gone, and that will actually put a lot more of your income, make it a lot more subject to income tax. So it's one of these revenue enhancement things. So slowly, bit by bit, the net is closing. The government eventually is going to get everybody's money in one way or another through the banks, through the slush funds they create, through becoming a landlord for millions and millions of Americans. It's pretty clear that part of the Democrat agenda, part of the liberal agenda, is to create a society where the government, one way or the other, controls all of the money, and there is really no such thing as private wealth anymore.
Well, that's what the communist dream has been since Marx, Lenin, and Trotsky. I mean, that's what they've been aiming for all this time. And so it's sad that it's going to happen in what was supposed to be a free market and capitalist country like the U.S., but that is one of the weaknesses in our constitutional system, is that we allow these infiltrators to come in, and they infiltrate and they state their agenda. There's been so many policies that have been passed that have been utter failures based on what they were stated to do. But if you look at what the dark side of what they're supposed to accomplish, they've been brilliant. I mean, NAFTA and GATT was an example, and I can think of dozens more.
This is the way that the social democrats, the Marxism-like types, like to do it. Proper outright raving communists like Lenin and Stalin and Mao and Castro basically kill the goose that lays the golden eggs. They just slaughter the capitalists, take all their resources, nationalize everything. This is pretty much to what Chavez did in Venezuela. But these European socialist types are much more subtle about it. They like to tame capitalism, tame free enterprise, tame the entrepreneurial spirit, and turn it into a cash cow to be milked to grow government. I know, God, I'm sounding like Rush Limbaugh here, but he does have a point. So this is what's happening in the country right now. And the question is, of course, what are we going to do about it? Now, I I went round and round a while back with one of these guys. I'm sure you've run across them. I think that if we can just somehow convince people through some historical fact by conveying that into their skulls full of mush, and if we can just get people to quote-unquote wake up, then that's all we have to do. And my answer to that all the time is, okay, fine, let's assume for the sake of argument that we've accomplished this fate and that everybody knows that the Jews ordered General Patton killed, or that 9/11 was a hoax, it was an Israeli conspiracy, and so forth and so on. Okay, this is it. The great fact has been registered with the public. It's into their brains now, and they say, wow, that's true, and everybody has woken up. Okay, now that everybody's awake, what do we do? The system, the military, the power, the wealth is in the hands of the racial enemy. It's like Boss Tweed told some reforming type back in New York, back in the Tammany Hall days. He said, I don't care, do what you want, yell at me all you want, call me all the names you want, it doesn't matter so long as I count the votes. And we're in a system right now where even if everybody was awake, it wouldn't matter because the enemy, the government, is counting the votes. And we have no way of compelling the government to obey their own laws or to do pretty much of anything except, of course, the one way that we won't use, which is the Second Amendment. That's the method that our ancestors gave to us for the purpose of compelling the government to play it straight, to rule by the will of the people, and to obey their own laws. But we won't use that one. So that's always my question to all these people who think that it can be done with internet or pep rallies or elections.
You know, because I've read your books, and I had a guest on a couple weeks ago, a guy named Ken O'Keefe, who is advocating it's time for direct action. I agree with that, but I don't think we need to go violent yet. And I say that with a great deal of trepidation, because if everyone would take their money out of the big banks and put it into a local credit union or something like that, if everyone would stop going to the chain restaurants or the chain stores, stop going to Walmart, stop going to Lowe's, support your local businesses, grow as much of your own food as you can, become as independent and self-reliant. Because if we could affect the top-line revenue of these big companies by 10, 20%, we'd force them into bankruptcy. We would bring them to their knees within a matter of weeks. But people have to all work together at the same time. And we don't have that level of coordination within our community.
Well, we're not going to get that either because we have no control over the mass media that forms the thought patterns and behavior patterns of the millions and millions of white Americans. This is why a site like northwestfront.org, my site, can after 4 years, we've only got 5,000 hits or so a week because the people simply do not know that we are there, and they're not going to be allowed to know that we are there. So the media is central to this whole problem, and one of the reasons that we keep losing is that we lost control of the media about 50 years ago.
We did, and we have a break coming up here. We'll be right back in a couple of minutes. All right, good deal. We'll be right back. Radio Network, and today is Monday, April 29th, 2013. My guest today is Harold Covington. And Harold, really, when are people going to know that it's time to take direct action and go the other direction? And I don't think we've exhausted the peaceful issues yet. But your point about the media being such a major player in this is all too true. I mean, I make a point of watching the Sunday news shows just to see what propaganda they're pushing, and I'm so offended by it these days. I used to like Fox News Sunday. I can't stand them now because I see through their BS. I see through their agenda. And we don't have that. You know, the best we're going to do is things like this, Rents Radio, and you know, a couple other Patriot Freedom type stations out there, networks. But we don't have nearly the market penetration that the mainstream does. Everybody's got a TV in their house, and everybody gets CNN or Fox 24/7. So how do we combat this?
I think we have made a mistake for a long time in believing that somehow or other we are going to create some kind of mass movement in this country with millions and millions and millions of people. I think probably the Tea Party did about as well at that as can be done. And they seem to be almost gone now. They seem to be just sort of a temporary flash in the pan, largely because the media, in essence, about early 2011, just simply stopped covering them. In addition to which, I noticed that a lot of their membership was, shall we say, very elderly. That's another problem that white people have is demographics. One of the reasons that we're becoming more and more outnumbered at the polls is that the elderly white conservative voters are simply dying off, and the young white dumbasses who are coming along behind them either just haven't got a clue as to what's going on, or they vote Democrat because they think it's cool to vote for a black guy.
And no, there's something else going on there, too, because if you remember back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, whites were told to limit the size of their family because of environmental issues, social responsibility issues, all these, and whites did. Whites did the responsible thing, according to that, but yet the minorities never did. They're still having, you know, 6, 8, 10, 12 kids on the public's dime. They don't care about the quality of life they live. They don't care about the education that their kids get. They just have a lot of kids. And to say that they don't care, that's not entirely accurate. I'm sure that some do care, but the majority of them just have kids for the sake of having kids because we incentivize them to have children through the setup of the welfare system.
Anyway, getting back to your question, we have to understand that we will never have a mass movement in this country so long as the overwhelming majority of the millions of white people who live here are never allowed to know that our side of things even exists. They are never allowed to hear what we have to say. We are never given a fair hearing. There is never a level playing field in the media. I mean, we do have logic and right and reason on our side, and if there was a level playing field and somebody like you and I could get up and publicly debate people like Arianna Huffington and Michael Moore and John Stewart and so forth, I'm sure we could convince the majority of our people that we were right, but that's never going to happen. So the result is we have to fall back on the old revolutionary paradigm of the small, extremely active and dedicated and, dare I say it, fanatical minority. They are the kind of people who actually change history because they will actually do things. They will act instead of speak. And I once knew many, many years ago an old Hungarian freedom fighter, one of the kids who was throwing Molotov cocktails at the Soviet tanks in Budapest in 1956. And he told me, he says, "You Americans are going to lose because you are fighting this most evil of all the forces in human history. You are fighting this evil with nothing but words, and evil will never surrender to mere words," and we have to start understanding this, and beyond that, we have to start being willing to undergo risk, inconvenience, danger, and death and imprisonment for the sake of a better future for our world. Put it this way, the white man's salvation in this country will come when we love our children better than we love our possessions.
I think that's a very wise statement you just made right there, that we have to care more about our kids and the future of our kids and their kids and our grandkids than we do about the stuff we have. And that's really what it's going to come down to is, do you want your genetic line to be crushed out? And that's what's going to happen here. And God bless Ronald Reagan. Loved him to death when he was president, but he made two terrible mistakes. One of them was that whole amnesty thing. If he had not done that amnesty and set the precedent, we wouldn't be talking about amnesty today. We'd still be on the Eisenhower model, which was to deport these illegals who are here. The other thing he did was broke up the PATCO union, the air traffic controllers. And those two things collectively were an assault on American labor and people's quality of life. Their earning potential has declined as a result of those two actions.
Americans are basically a very materialistic people. There is almost no spiritual element left in white American life, unless you want to count some of these, you know, 700 club Zionist type churches. And I don't consider them to be a religion anyway. I consider them to be political. But America controls white people through their possessions, through their wealth, through their things. And this is what whites have been taught to treasure all their lives. Every now and then I'll go into some office or something and I'll see a little sign on the wall, one of these little humorous things that says, "Life is a game and he who dies with the most toys wins." And that is the attitude that a lot of white Americans have about life as a whole, that it's all one big race from cradle to grave to accumulate as much as you can in the way of material wealth and goodies and toys and status symbols and that sort of stuff. And so when that is threatened, when Americans are threatened with poverty, then they basically fold like a lawn chair. That has to stop. We have to find a small minority of white Americans who can still hear the call of racial duty, who are still capable of seeing a bigger picture and who are still capable of pledging their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor to the betterment of their people and their country, as did our founding fathers. I'm convinced that those people are out there. The problem is they're not being allowed to know that we exist or that any alternative exists. Our challenge is to use what communications media we have access to, be it the internet or Rents Radio or my podcast or whatever, find these people. Somehow or another, they have to be dragged to northwestfront.org or to one of my novels or to something that will show them that there is an alternative. Before they can be convinced to pledge their lives to that alternative, they have to know that it exists. And this is where the control of the media is strangling us. And in essence, we're faced with the same problem that Commander Rockwell was faced with back in the 60s. He called it breaking through the paper curtain. Bear in mind, this was when there was only three TV networks and the media meant the newspapers. But he was blacked out just as the Northwest Front is blacked out today. Somehow or other, we have to find some way to break through this blackout and to let the millions of white people who would respond to our message know that we are here.
I think that is absolutely a key consideration, but how do you get there from here?
I can't see any way at this point other than just keep on plugging away with what we're doing bit by bit. The trouble is we might not have time to do that. There is always the chance that there might be some, shall we say, divine intervention in the form of a major newsworthy or catastrophic event, which I won't get into the possibilities as to what that could be, which would, say, focus all of the world's attention briefly on the Northwest Front and on the idea of a white homeland. The trouble is, I'm not sure whether or not we could survive that, depending on what the great event was, because I'm sure the enemy would try to work it up into some kind of conspiracy or use it in some way to destroy the whole movement. We just don't know. But there has to be some kind of breaking out of the bubble. And I admit, I'm not totally sure how it can be brought about. And the only thing I can think of to do is to get as many boots on the ground as possible, get them talking to others, get them distributing literature, get them working on the internet. Yes, I hate the internet, but we need it. And to just keep on plugging away and just hoping to God that at some point we will see a window of opportunity and we'll be able to take it. And we'll be able to do something that will bring us to the notice of the millions upon millions upon millions of white Americans who are so desperately looking for what we have to offer.
Well, how do we get there from here? That's the question. And then the other question is if there is direct action. Now, I've read your books, and I notice that, well, I'll save the question for the other side of the hour. Harold, this is our longer break where we have the top of the news. So if you need to get a cup of coffee, glass of water, whatever, it's a good time. We'll be right back, folks, right after this. More with Harold Covington. Welcome back to the second hour of the show. This is Mike Harris on RentsRadio.com. My guest today is Harold Covington, author and social commentator. Today is Monday, April 29th, 2013. Harold, welcome back.
Glad to be here.
Okay, where do we leave off at? Because I dropped my train of thought in that long break there. So we got to start over again.
Okay.
But anyway, the whole thing is what I've been urging people almost on a daily basis here is to come to the conclusion that there ain't no Superman. We have to do this ourselves. And if we don't develop a new vision, a new direction for this country, that the direction and the vision that's being put on us by the bad guys is what we're going to have to live with. And I don't want to live with that. That's why one of the things I found so inspiring about your books were that you don't accept that vision. You don't have it crammed down your throat. We're getting it crammed down our throat 24/7. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned about the media earlier, and You know, it's they just don't quit. I mean, they are just they're relentless. They're brutal. They're just pounding this endless message on, and yeah. They don't even consider other points of view. I mean,
it's been worse since Obama was reelected. If you look at things like Huffington Post or Salon Magazine, anyone who disagrees with them in public, be it Limbaugh or the Sean Hannity or any conservative politician, they are going. I've never seen it this savage, this vicious.
I look at the Hannitys and the Limbaughs and the O'Reillys. I look at those guys as being the controlled opposition, because this immigration debate that's going on, we're not hearing a debate. We're hearing, oh, we're going to have a new amnesty. That's all we're hearing. We're not hearing anything about, well, folks, do you think we should deport these people who broke the law and came here illegally? And you get these lame excuses that, well, if we can't deport them, there's just too many of them to deport. Well, no, there's not. You know, we can do this. We just have to have the political will. But that concept of deportation is never even brought up.
No, you never hear it.
You never hear it.
Well, you were asking, or you were speaking earlier, Mike, about how do we, get this thing going. I think you kind of touched on something a minute ago. You referred to people like Hannity, Limbaugh, and the conservatives, the Republicans, et cetera, as the controlled opposition. What we need to do is we need to become the opposition, the real opposition, and the white people of the country need to know that there is an opposition out there, that there is somebody they can turn to besides these neocons who just basically want to keep them in the same old playpen.
Neocon is another word for Bolshevik, in my opinion. And you look at the neocons out of the Bush White House, and 90% of them are dual citizen U.S. Israelis. And I don't trust them with the fate of my country or foreign policy or any other government function, because their loyalty is divided. And I just flat out do not trust them. And I think they should be looked into and investigated for all of their potential treasons against the U.S. And if you're going to be a dual citizen, you cannot serve in this government.
Yeah. Well, that's why I'm so embarrassed at times, because it sounds like I'm pro-Republican, and I'm not. Like I say, I remember what it was like under Bush. I remember all the horrors in Iraq and the Green Zone and the embassy and all the things that they did and the whole idiotic tenure of that administration. That was scary. You had some of these dispensationalist types who wanted to start a nuclear war in the Middle East, make Jesus come back and all this sort of stuff. That was scary. But the fact is, unfortunately, Obama is the devil we've got to deal with now. And he succeeds in getting these illegals amnestied and creating his permanent underclass, which will serve as a permanent electoral majority for Obama and the Democrats. And later on, people like Hillary and Andrew Cuomo and whatnot, they're going to be the devils we'll be dealing with from now on. Because if the Republicans don't get their act together and do something to put a stop to this immigration madness, they are never going to see the Oval Office again. I hear a dog in there.
There's a dog somewhere.
Okay.
But, the thing is, without the illegals being granted amnesty, if we can keep them out and really get them out of this country, we still have a chance for an economic recovery. But if, like you said, we have a new 50 million, 60 million person permanent underclass, in addition to the permanent underclass we already have here that's already indigenous here, then we're never going to dig our way out of this hole. It's going to be poverty from one end to the other, and they're going to bankrupt everybody. So there's a lot of guys out there I know who are in that. They got 5, 10, 20 million bucks. They're not the super rich, but they're super comfortable. And those guys are the next target to get cleaned out. They're not going to have nothing left if this comes to pass.
Well, you mentioned having to get them out of the country, et cetera. See, this is something that I have to tell people right up front, and I don't like saying it, and they don't like hearing it, but how exactly are we going to do that? I mean, granted that the 11 million figure is way low. Realistically, let's just not quibble. Let's say it's somewhere between 30 and 50 million illegals in this country. Now, let's be honest, Mike. How exactly are we going to get them out? It would be possible, I suppose, if we had an absolutely loyal and determined president and Congress, and we had an absolutely loyal and white American military. Yeah, maybe then we could forcibly deport that many people. But I'm afraid, and like I say, I hate to be the bearer of bad tidings, but I think we have passed the point of no return. I believe this country is headed for a Soviet-style breakup of some kind, because if for no other reason, the demographics now dictate it. In order to get these millions and millions and millions of people who do not belong here out of this country, it would require an act of political will and political strength, which simply does not exist anywhere in the governmental structure. So what we're going to see is a breakup of some kind. And I honestly believe that we have to proceed on that basis. The only other alternative I can see to some kind of actual physical political separation, as in my Northwest American Republic, and I still think that's the way it's going to go, it is, I suppose, just possible, just barely possible, that whites could recover a few states on a state government level. States like Idaho, Iowa, what we call red states. Texas, by the way, is about to go blue. They figure in the next election it might go blue because of all those Mexicans down there and because of all the non-whites and immigrants. And again, because the elderly white conservatives, Republican types, they're simply dying out. That might be possible, but still what you'd have then be a sort of a checkerboard pattern broken up into enclaves, and many of those all-white states are landlocked, and so that would not bode well. I honestly believe, Mike, that we have to proceed on the assumption that there is going to be some kind of collapse of the central government of the United States of America. We've talked about this on your show before. It will come when there is an attack on Iran that cuts off one-third of the imported energy from the Middle East. It may come when they run out of money. It may become when Ben Bernanke fires up those printing presses and basically makes American money worthless. It could come in any number of ways. But that's what's coming. And
let me address your first issue, and that is you don't think it's possible to get the 30 to 50 million illegals out of this country.
Not without applying military force of a
I think we can. And I think the pressure needs to be put on, number one, the employers. Those who employ them need to be penalized because they know what they're doing. They're committing fraud against the people. They're really betraying their own country and their own countrymen, really, by hiring these illegals. And, you know, there's certain jobs that young people in this country can't get, whether you're black or white. You can't get hired unless you're Hispanic to be a dishwasher. I'm sorry. They don't hire blacks. They don't hire white kids to be dishwashers anymore. They just don't do it. But the issue is if we had to get them out of here in 6 months, it would be a challenge. But I look at like Sky Harbor Airport in Arizona, and I think, what is the annual carrying capacity? That place passes 48 million people through there on an annualized basis. Could we do something similar to that if we took a year or 3 years to get them all out of here? And you'll find them, send them home, just pack them up and send them home. I don't think it would require that big of a force. I think
what it would require would be political will.
Political will. That's what we need. That's the missing ingredient. We'll be right back, folks. More with Harold Covington after this. Good afternoon. This is Mike Harris on RinksRadio.com. Today is Monday, April 29th, 2013. My guest today is Harold Covington. And Harold, you know, I remember back when this talk 4, 5, 6 years ago started talking about a new amnesty under the Bush administration, when they wanted to talk about this. And I remember some Hispanic activist came on and says, it would be impossible to deport these people. You would have buses lined up from the Mexican border all the way to the Canadian border. And that was an attempt to kill the concept of deportation. I think the concept of deportation is alive and well, and I think it can be done. It's just a matter of, as a function of time. You have to remember, these people didn't get here overnight, and we're not going to get rid of them overnight either. It's kind of like having bed bugs. You got to come in for multiple treatments.
Right.
I think once people realize that the burden these people are on our society, the damage they're doing to our culture, to our country, and once we begin to get rid of them and lighten the parasite load, I think that people will embrace this and get behind it. But you said the key words, and that is political will. And like you said, we don't even have anything at all that we can't even get the word out there that, you know, the American people prefer deportation. I mean, 69%, and this is a Fox News poll, so I think it's skewed, but 69% of the people do not favor another amnesty. They do not favor it. And so I think it's probably closer to 80% don't favor another amnesty, because I think Fox, although portraying themselves as being a conservative voice, is really the controlled opposition. So I think that we cannot give up on this dream of deporting these people and taking the country back.
Okay, well, I'm tempted to ask you how you propose to get a government in office that will actually do it, but I think you also hit one key element there, Mike, and that is the employers. You're from Arizona. Maybe I'm just missing it in the news story, but tell me, down there in Arizona, do any of these employers who employ these illegals ever actually go to prison? Do you see them doing the perp walk in shackles and the orange jumpsuits?
You know, Arizona has passed a couple of laws that are supposed to be able to revoke the business license for the business doing it, seize the assets, et cetera, et cetera. But these things are tied up with these endless court challenges. You know, the ACLU loves to get involved, and they do this technique that I call lawfare. And if they don't like legislation that is actually good for the American people, they tie it up in court forever, and they make it very expensive to defend such actions. I see your point. I really do. I understand your point. I understand where you're at. But I'm just trying to keep things peaceful because I don't want to shake this country up that much. These people need to go home. They've got a place to be. They need to go back there.
I agree. And, okay, I want to choose my words very carefully here because I don't want either of our doors to be kicked in the dawn. But, Mike, there comes a time when you have to make a moral choice. You can either lie down and accept whatever a tyrant chooses to impose upon you, be it walking all over you or kicking your face in with his steel-toed boots or whatever he chooses to do, or you can stand up to him and you can accept the fact that in the process of resisting what he is doing, you're going to be hurt, you're going to lose things that are dear to you, people that are dear to you. You must accept the fact that there is a price to be paid if you want to be free. We in this country are now at that point. In the back of everyone's mind in America, we all know that the system we live under is totally, completely corrupt and evil. We all know what has to be done. I believe that millions of people out there are sitting there in expectation, waiting for someone else to do it, because that is how Americans have been raised in the 20th and 21st century. So somebody has got to step up, or else these bastards are going to win. If we don't do something, Mike, in 100 years, there's not going to be any people that look like you and me remaining on this continent. And I'm not saying that as a joke. Please try and understand. Imagine what I've just said is something that is real, something that's going to happen, because it is going to happen. This is the situation in which we find ourselves. Now, at some point, we have to decide whether or not we're going to accept that. We're going to have to decide whether or not we're just going to toddle off to whatever we've been able to find for our retirement and sit there tapping on a computer a bit, muttering into a podcast microphone and popping the top on a 12-pack of beer, and simply accept the fact that we have lost and, in essence, we're just running out the clock, waiting to die and hoping to God we die quick enough so we don't have to see the worst effects of what's coming, you know, kind of an upper mile of deluge type attitude. And a lot of people in the movement I know have made just that decision. I've actually had some of them tell me that they've made their peace with the system. They've accepted that the way of life, the America, the world that they knew is doomed and gone forever. The people who made it are going to be gone soon, and it's depressing. Now, I am not going to do that. I believe that it is possible to fight. I believe that it is possible that out there, somewhere in America, there are the small number of people we need who still have that old alpha gene and who are capable of making a moral decision to resist. I am trying to bring those people together here in the Pacific Northwest. I am trying to motivate them, organize them, and get them working for some kind of future for our people and our race. Best put, I think, in the 14 words of David Lane, we must secure the existence of our people and the future for white children. I believe that that can be done. But whether we're going to do it or not, that's not my call.
Okay, well, here's the break. And I want to come back. I want to ask you about when is the time for direct action. I'll be right back in a minute, right, folks. Stick with us. More with Harold Covington. Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on RinceRadio.com, and today is Monday, April 29th, 2013. My guest today is Harold Covington, author and social commentator, and I highly recommend his books. They are a fun read. Now, that being said, Harold, I want to make sure that this next part of the conversation is strictly hypothetical, and it's based on actions that you fictionally devised in your novels. Where we talk about direct action, you look at some of the things in the book that, and I understand you have great artistic liberty, you know, literature license, if you will, when you write about these things, just to make it a good story, and a lot of them were. But whenever you look at applying some of the lessons of your books to real life, that is a frightening, frightening thing for people to do. Nobody wants to be the guy who pulls a gun on an FBI agent and drops him. You know, I don't want to be that guy because your life as you know it is over. They will hunt you like a dog. And these are the type of things, the ethnic cleansing of neighborhoods to rid right. them of black and brown people and other things. These are harsh, harsh medicines. And like I said, it's written in fiction. This is all hypothetical. But, you know, how much despair do people have to have? I don't expect you to have an answer on this. But how much despair would you have to have in order to have to do those things as your last recourse?
In my novel, the shooting phase starts when you've got a program called It Takes a Village, which I named after Hillary Clinton's book, wherein the federal government, in essence, seizes the children of so-called racist or politically incorrect white people and more or less auctions them off to wealthy homosexuals and liberals because of the shortage of white children on the adoption market, which, by the way, is something that's true. And we are getting indications that this type of thing is starting to occur in American society, by the way. I seem to have something of a gift of prophecy. Anyway, they swoop in on the home of a man named Augustus Singer in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, on one morning in October 22nd specifically, because Mr. Singer and his wife apparently are old believers. They're pagans, and they've named their children Siegfried and Freya, Nordic names, and apparently they've been reported for teaching their children Norse myths and the old religion, etc., and that, of course, is racism, and therefore a federal officer of some kind, a judge, a U.S. attorney, has signed an order for the Singer children to be seized and, in essence, sold off. And so the feds come in their black body armor and their automatic weapons, yelling and screaming and hollering and kicking in the door. Gus Singer resists. And to everyone's amazement, all of a sudden, up and down the street, the windows open, and all of the local people have gone to their basement hiding places or their attics, taken their guns out of their hiding places, and they all open up on the federal law enforcement officers and cut them down. Now, of course, the Singer family dies because it turns into a kind of a Waco thing, and it's all very tragic. But the significant thing there is that the people of that particular part of the world, Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, had finally had enough. And what triggered it in this case was this monster, this thing in Washington, D.C., coming for their children. So that's in my novel what happened. Now, in actual practice, just between you and me, there may be some kind of triggering incident like that. I don't think so, but if it does happen, my guess is that it will happen when they try the first actual gun raids, physically coming to people's homes to take away firearms. Now, we all hear this stuff about they'll have my gun when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers. Well, I have a certain amount of skepticism about that. Maybe I'm wrong, and I hope in a sense that I am wrong, because no one wants to disarm you unless he means to do you harm. This is just obvious. And when it gets to the point where the men in the black body armor are coming into your home and forcibly taking your firearms so that you can't defend yourself, that is the last opportunity that you will have to defend yourself, because if you let them take your guns, then you won't have anything anymore, and you pretty much got to do whatever they say from now on, because you're not going to have the means to resist. So that might trigger some kind of incident, which in turn would balloon into some kind of Waco-like situation or Ruby Ridge-type situation, whereby the media could not suppress it. And if, say, some federal officers were killed, instead of media silence, you would all of a sudden have a media feeding frenzy, and too late they would realize that what they were doing was they were letting millions of white people know that somebody was resisting. This could trigger some kind of armed resistance. Then, of course, there's the idea of building a revolutionary vanguard in some corner of the world or some corner of the continent, say the Pacific Northwest, and dividing up into cells and teams and being ready for such an incident if and when it occurs, or being ready to take advantage of whatever does happen to open a window of opportunity, which is frankly what we are doing here in the Northwest. And I'm sure the FBI and other people are listening, but I've made no bones about that. I believe that there is going to be this Soviet-style breakup, and I think we have to be ready for it when it happens.
What I think is going to be one of our next great challenges in this country is I think we're looking at an economic collapse. I think that this derivatives problem, this derivatives bubble that's out there, which is anywhere from, on the lowest estimate I've heard is $600 trillion. The highest I've heard is over $4 quadrillion. Now remember that 4 times 10 to the 15th. That's a big number. I mean, and there isn't enough money on the planet to repay this. And when this thing bursts, when it happens, and the financial system shuts down, you know, they're going to have to declare a bank holiday. And then your credit cards aren't going to work, your debit cards aren't going to work, and your EBT card is not going to work.
That's
so, unless you have cash in your hand, you're not going to be able to buy food or gas or anything else. So a lot of people are going to be with the food they have in their refrigerator, the gas they have in their tank is what they have. And then panic's going to set in. And I think it's going to get really, really terrible, really, really quick. And I look at that as a more likely type of incident. Because I don't think that's something that the feds can put a stop on.
Yeah, something like that is entirely possible. The thing is, though, what you're talking about there, Mike, is in essence mass rioting, the type of trouble all over the country that would cause a collapse of the federal authority. Now, that is to the good. All of a sudden, if there's mass rioting in Houston and Chicago and Los Angeles and Miami and just everywhere, the government won't have the manpower to suppress it all. And in any case, the rioting might be caused by a lack of money, as you say, some kind of financial collapse, in which case the government will not be able to pay their mercenaries, their military, their cops, their FBI and Homeland Security agents, et cetera, et cetera. So, okay, what you've got there is a collapse of the central authority in Washington, D.C. But again, the question is, once that happens, what are you going to do? Somebody has got to be ready to step in and take over and take advantage of that window of opportunity, do what is necessary to acquire white homeland for us, and so forth. Now, people ask me sometimes, well, when will be the time for the NBA phase, if ever? Again, speaking strictly hypothetical, all the usual disclaimers is read, blah, 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 blah. I tell them that's when the governor of Oregon or the mayor of Seattle can no longer pick up the telephone and call for the 82nd Airborne of the 3rd Marine Division to back him up. When it's just our people on the ground against their people on the ground.
Well, Harold, hold that thought. We'll be right back after this short break from our sponsors. More with Harold Covington. Be right back, folks. Good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on RinceRadio.com. Today is Monday, April 29, 2013. My guest today is Harold Covington. And let me give a note. My guest tomorrow is going to be Frosty Wooldridge because I'm not going to let this illegal immigration issue lie. Frosty is one of my favorite experts on the subject. And this is a serious line in the sand time, folks, because we can't let this amnesty happen for these folks. They have a country. They need to go home. They broke the law to get here. They break the law to stay here. They bring drugs, they bring crime, they bring a lot of bad things with them. They need to go back. We owe them nothing. They need to go home. Anyway, Harold, welcome back. And where I want to direct this to is I look at what you've written as probably the best contingency plan that I've heard so far. But I don't want to rely on that as my first option. But I agree with you that somebody's got to be able to keep the power plant running. Somebody's got to be able to keep the sewage plant running. Somebody's got to be able to keep the things that we look at as being a first world civilized society in place and running. We know that the blacks and the Mexicans can't do it, so it has to be white people who do it.
Well, I get a lot of these people in the movement down through the years, and they keep talking about when the balloon goes up and we're going to go back to this primitive society where either we'll be out on the frontier in the 1850s, firing black powder muskets, or we'll be in a Mad Max type situation where everyone's riding up and down the road in Humvees with crossbows and purple mohawks, you know, this sort of stuff. Nobody in his right mind wants to go back to the mid-19th century or the Middle Ages or anything like that. I'm a historian. I'm fascinated by history. Roman Empire, Middle Ages, I like it all, but I don't want to live there. Nobody sane does. I think our object needs to be to preserve as much of white Western civilization as we can, not start over. Now, it is possible that we may be forced to, in essence, go back a century or two and resume our progress from kind of the place we went wrong. And if that has to happen, if that's the only way for our race to survive, okay, fine. But I really would like to save as much of the good things as Western civilization has come up with as we can. And so we need to look for some way to kind of strike a middle ground between total surrender and destruction through miscegenation and assimilation and diversity on the one hand, and going back to the Bronze Age on the other hand. I believe that's possible. If you take this idea of white separatism and taking back the country or taking back the world piece by piece, it makes a lot more sense. One of the things that the Northwest Imperative does is it reduces the problem to manageable proportions. Instead of trying to take over this huge continent of about 300 million people, maybe 350 if you include Canada, you're reducing your geographical area to a large area, to be sure. The three states that we're claiming to begin with, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and Montana, west of Interstate 15, that's a pretty big area where we need a big homeland, but still, it's not the whole United States. And the population is approximately 20, 21 million people, of whom about 90% are white. And the non-whites are concentrated in about four or five large urban areas, Seattle, Portland, Spokane, a few others. And so all of a sudden, this thing that we claim that we've been wanting to do all these decades here in the United States through building up a revolutionary organization and changing the world, etc., all of a sudden it's possible because there are still enough of us left and we could find enough people who would be willing to do this to carry out this change in this smaller and more restricted area. And also what we're doing here in the Northwest, we're changing the whole paradigm. We are transforming the nature of the struggle into a colonial war, wherein you have a people who desire to separate a certain colony or stretch of territory from a larger empire. Now, there are precedents and there are templates as to how that can be done. We look at history, we can kind of build ourselves a little roadmap. And so when you take something like the Northwest Imperative, all of a sudden the job looks a lot more feasible and a lot more manageable. If someone were to come to me and present me with some kind of plan to take back all of the United States from sea to shining sea, get all these people who don't belong here out of here, and I include blacks in that and Jews and homosexuals, but let's, in other words, clean up the whole country from top to bottom. If someone were to explain to me how that can be done, I mean, really, I would abandon the Northwest idea and say, hey, guy, we've got no idea, but we don't.
I have to tell you something. If your Northwest concept were to be successful, I think it would grow exponentially. And I think you might take over the rest of the continental landmass by default, because no one would want to be in the old areas that are fully integrated, if you will. They'd want to be where life is better.
I deal with this in the last of the five Northwest novels, Freedom's Sons, which is details the first 50 years of the Republic's existence. It's a fictional treatment, of course, and most of it's just speculation on my part as to what might happen, what obstacles the Republic might meet, etc. But that is possible. And if that's the case, if it would be possible to use, say, the Northwest Republic as a stepping stone to take back the rest of the country, and we do talk about this issue in Freedom's Sons to some degree, but if that turns out to be possible and feasible in real life, then to my mind, that is one more reason why we need to quit messing around and we need to get behind this Northwest thing and get this thing going. My one fear, Mike, is that we are going to miss our window of opportunity because we're stalling and fiddle-faddling around with all kinds of things that don't matter while the Rome that we knew is burning around us.
Well, I definitely think Rome is burning. I need to ask your opinion. I'm going to give a little conversation whiplash. I'm going to take it another direction here. What is your opinion on this Boston bombing? I mean, you and I have not discussed this yet. I was just curious about this, BB, because we're getting short on time.
Right.
And I want to kind of circle back and bring this more to current events. So what do you think happened there?
Well, the official media rap is that it was, they call them cut-rate jihadists or something like that, just a couple of Muslim kids who decided one day that they were tired of being middle-class Americans in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and they were going to go blow up the Boston Marathon. That's stretching it a little to me, because I'm familiar with the whole Chechen thing, and let me put it this way, once a Chechen, always a Chechen. What I think happened is that these two Chernayev guys were probably involved, just like Timothy McVeigh was probably involved in Oklahoma City to some degree, but we keep hearing stories about strange red-bearded men and that sort of stuff. And I don't know. It could be that someone put them up to it. The question is why. Now, Franklin Delano Roosevelt said that nothing is coincidental in politics. Anytime something like this happens, you need to look at Ki Bono. In whose interest is it for right now, all of a sudden, there to be another terrorist scare? I will say this. If this is outright proper Islamic terrorism, it's the first, in my view, genuine incident of Islamic terrorism in this country since 9/11. And we won't get into 9/11 because I'm aware of the problems with 9/11. But I think you see what I'm saying. I don't consider that Fort Hood thing to be actual, quote unquote, Islamic terrorism as such. I think that was just one guy that flipped out. He couldn't belong to an army that was slaughtering his own people, and the pressure just got to him, and he flipped out with a gun. But if this is a genuine Islamic attack in Boston, it is really, really rare, because I think one of the most remarkable things about 9/11 is the fact that it hasn't happened again in all the 12 years since then.
My opinion on this Boston thing is that it was a false flag, done by DHS and or other government entities in conjunction with the drill they already had planned. And you look at the number of drills and the number of incidents that they've had, and it's too tight. They've overused this template. They've overused the playbook, and people are seeing through it. But Boston was an obvious false flag, in my opinion.
Well, you kind of wonder, though, what would be the motive? It does seem to have had at least some adverse effect on the administration's immigration bill and the gun control thing, because the gun control thing did fail to pass the Senate on, like, the same day the bomb went off, something like that. I mean, I am very paranoid when I see coincidence in politics of any kind, and I do tend to look and see who benefits. But the trouble with American politics and with world politics the past 50 years, there's so much going on behind the scenes that we will probably never know what actually happened. Like, who killed the Colorado prison commandant and why? That incident has now dropped off the radar.
Well, it has it, and that's an incident that's worth looking into, taking a second look, a deeper look. Well, Harold, I hear our background music coming up again, and you know, I can't believe the 2 hours went by so quick, but it did. I want to thank you very much. It's always a pleasure to have you on. I love your perspectives, and folks, read his books. I'm telling you, he's got good ideas, and the concept is sound. Go read his books.
Okay, I always like to be here. Mike, thanks a lot.
All right, Harold, have a good day. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Folks, tomorrow my guest is Frosty Wooldridge, and we're not giving up on this illegal immigration issue, because this is a game changer, and we have to stop this thing. So, folks, be back tomorrow with Frosty Wooldridge. Thanks again. Bye-bye.